Women have always been interested in reading, and they've always been good readers. This book is aimed at any woman who reads.
We even thought about that groovy aunt going into the bookstore one day and saying, "What do I buy for my favorite niece?" This is the book she buys.
Literary historians Linda Wagner-Martin and Kathy Davidson. Their new book is The Oxford Companion to Women's Writing in the United States. They'll be back in just a moment to talk about it and to reflect on women's issues in the 1990s. This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Join me now for the first in a series of four conversations for Women's History Month. Partial support for this program comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. One of the contradictions of American culture is that although women writers have enriched our literature from the beginning, it's only recently that women have found a legitimate place for themselves in our literary history. But a literary culture by and about white males is a thing of the past. And now, with the publication of The Oxford Companion to Women's Writing in the United States, work by and about women has a reference book of its own. For Women's History Month 1995, the editors-in-chief of that volume are here now to talk about their new book. Linda Wagner-Martin teaches at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, Kathy Davidson at Duke University. The Oxford Companion to Women's Writing in the United States includes more than 800 entries and 400 biographical essays, offering a wide-ranging survey of women's writing, women's history, women's concerns from African American, Asian American, Chicano, Latina, Native American, and other literary traditions. I asked Linda Wagner-Martin to explain why now is the time for the Oxford Companion to Women's Writing in the United States.
We had each waited about 20 years to have a good reference book that talked about the different kinds of things one needs to know, not just biographies of women writers. So the book wasn't forthcoming, so we decided 5 years ago that we'd do it ourselves.
Where there is a need, there is a way. Is
absolutely.
That right?
And when Oxford came to us and asked us to do this, we said we'd do it on one condition, and that's that we wanted to redefine what an encyclopedia looked like, how it read, what it was about. And instead of just short entries, we have long discursive entries that actually have controversies and debates in them.
Now, this book, in a way, goes to a kind of an academic, not a vacuum, but an academic development, a series of events over, what, the past 20, 25 years. We're talking about feminism. We're talking about women's studies. We're talking about marginality, putting women into the American literary canon. Have I got this right?
Yes, although you make it sound a little negative. women have always been American.
Why should we not think of it that way then?
Well, I think we have to realize that it's been the teachers and the critics who have ghettoized women's work.
The writers have always been out there.
The writers have always been there.
And in fact, always been the most popular writers. I mean, from the very beginnings, women's writing has sold more than men's writing, and there are more women readers than men readers, and there always have been. It's interesting.
Tell me about how you organize this book, Linda, Kathy. You talk about, I mean, you go all over the map in this companion, from, sort of the high-flown academic subjects to recipes, things like that. Kathy, what about it?
Well, the way we organized things is we sat around the table with our five advisors and we thought about everything we possibly would want to think about and read about as we were reading a book. And we had a sort of model. If we were reading Toni Morrison's Beloved, for example, what would we want to think about? We'd want to think about slavery. We'd want to think about mothers and daughters, mothers and children. We'd want to think about the abolitionist movement. We'd want to talk about African-American women writers. There was a whole constellation of ideas, spiritualism, spirituality, religion, ghosts. Mm-hmm. And we thought, if it's in women's writing, we want it in our book. We want to talk about it in our book.
So. Now, one of the sacred principles I take here was to be, Linda, as inclusive as possible, and yet you couldn't put everything into a companion like this. What were the principles of organization?
Well, Oxford helped, I must say. They have a whole reference system, and they made us keep creating these grids, which took the better part of the first year, so that we wouldn't have missed you know, if we had grandmothers in a Native American entry, then we had to have grandmothers in an Asian American entry and that kind of thing.
Uh-huh. And if we had grandmothers, we also had to have aunts and grandfathers and grandmothers. And Oxford did keep us on track and make sure there was that kind of balance.
Let me be a little contentious with you, Linda and Kathy. Is this an anti-male book? Because it's called The Oxford Companion to Women's Writing. Does that mean that you are excluding men, that somehow or other they don't figure in what goes on in this book, Linda?
I think you'd be surprised looking at the index at how many men are mentioned and how many men's issues, if we're going to divide things into that kind of a sphere, are included. But no, the focus was on giving readers information that they would have difficulty finding in standard mainstream reference books.
Is this an ideological sort of book, Kathy? That is to say, you English professors have frequently been charged with, you know, politicking in the classroom, politicking in your publications. Tell me about that.
I guess I would say it was a good book and an inclusive book, and in terms of covering the whole range of women's writing. If someone wants to think that's ideological, that may be the case. But we were more concerned in filling gaps, and not just in filling gaps in standard reference books, but also showing that given the topic, women's writing, there was an enormous range from ultra-conservative women writers to ultra-radical women writers, and that we were interested in representing that whole range along the ideological spectrum. And one sort of, I guess, the ideological point of the book is there's no such thing as woman, it's women. And we're interested in women's writing and the many, many varieties of women's writing that have been produced from the beginning of America to the present.
Let's pause on the word writing and the word women's. Linda, you were telling me before we began our recording session that you were very careful in the way you phrased the title of this book. Tell me about that.
Well, we didn't want it to be seen as just another listing of important women writers. We wanted to kind of redefine what meaningful writing is, even if it doesn't fall into known categories of literature, novel, poetry, whatever. So we have letters, we have the recipes, contextualized because recipe writers often explained why they were writing as they were writing. We have a lot of private writing as well as published formal writing.
Well, I can tell you, I say this with an absolutely straight face, and I mean no disrespect, and I'm not patronizing your topic. My mother-in-law will read cookbooks the way you and I might read novels or poetry. I mean, they have a kind of engagement and verve for her. Now, there may be a stuffy old literary critic out there listening to this and saying, give me a break, that is not literature. Would you please attack or defend?
Well, I'm not sure if it's literature or not, because the definition of literature has always changed. I mean, for example, in the 19th century, novels were considered they weren't considered literature. The essay was the only real form of literature, and we barely consider that literary now. So I think the definition is always changing, and your mother-in-law is probably right. Cookbooks are a form of literature, and very famous writers have chosen to write in that form.
Absolutely.
And we have an entry on recipe books, which was the old name for cookbooks, and it's a history of cookbooks in America, again, from the beginnings to the present.
Let's run down some of the, this is an amazing range of topics, themes, writers, poets, novelists, regions that you include in the Oxford Companion to Women's Writing in the United States. Race and ethnicity. Now, those are two very large terms for you. I will look at you wide-eyed. Linda, why are they important, please?
We tried in this book to provide overall coverage so the terms were not just fragmented. And key critics were asked to write these large overview essays. So this is an attempt to put in common, fairly common language, the issues connected with the reasons we're broadening the canon on most campuses, in most courses, to include representations of various races and various ethnic groups.
Is there a lot of theory behind that, Kathy? Theory is a big word in the academy. Does it figure in your book?
It does, and it doesn't. I mean, we tried to represent, to make a book that could be exciting for an undergraduate taking their first theory course and learning all kinds of terms for the first time and not really knowing how to explain or understand those terms. But there are other entries that you don't have to know a thing about theory to understand. And in fact, if anything, we think this is a book that helps make theory comprehensible and helps make theory pertinent and relevant to larger issues, so that you can not only read essays about African-American writing, but read theories of race and how we've evolved certain theories of race, but in very comprehensible language that your mother-in-law, again, could read.
Sure,
she might decide to read this book as well as her cookbook sometime.
Are you bringing new takes, for example, to what appears to be a commonplace term, motherhood, daughterhood, fatherhood? What's going on in your entries there, Linda?
I think the consistent pattern throughout the book is that we've asked each of our authors to use specific references to pieces of writing, so that the abstractness of sisterhood, for example, gets grounded in a reference to Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin. And this way, if the reader knows the work, then that adds substance to, and many of these larger sounding entries will refer to a dozen different texts.
Does that mean that the book is allusive? That is to say, it refers to these examples. Is it really sort of redefining what we think of when we talk about motherhood or fatherhood or sisterhood, Kathy?
I think it does. I think it does precisely by making visible what the categories are and how they're used by writers. And as soon as somebody is making examples and tying sort of theoretical or conceptual issues to texts, writers write about a multiplicity of experience, so you see the texture of what motherhood is like. It's going to be very, very different for somebody in the 18th century who has lost her sister or perhaps her own mother to childbirth and who's now facing the prospects of motherhood herself.
Now, this is a kind of a dangerous exercise, isn't it, Linda? I mean, we North Americans, in the middle class, we love our stereotypes. We love our little Norman Rockwell pictures and boxes with the little ribbon on top. I get the impression that this book really is going to upset some apple carts. Am I right about that? Did you do this deliberately?
The real brilliance in the book, Wayne, is that the people we asked to write the essays did it. They upset the apple cart. So that it wasn't a formulaic kind of principle, but when a critic, an established critic, is asked to look at mother-daughter relationships in American letters, she doesn't have anywhere to really go. She has to create that essay of 2,500 words or so for herself. And this is why it's an important book.
Well, this is like the poetry of Walt Whitman, right, Kathy? You're reinventing the wheel as you move right down the road.
Well, that's absolutely the case. And one of the things that's been exciting is how many of our authors...
I should have said Emily Dickinson.
Many of our authors who wrote essays for this book are now writing books based on the essays they wrote. In other words, we would give them a topic off the top of our heads. We'd say, write about recipes, or write about sex goddesses, or write about domesticity. I mean, domesticity's been written about more, but other kinds of topics, and they would get so excited. They'd realize there was enough material here for a book. They were the first people to do it, and they wanted also to then write a definitive study. So there's dozens of books being generated by individual entries in this book. So this is also a kind of reader's guide, condensed version of books that are about to come out, of scholarship about to appear.
Let's talk about some of the unusual entries in the Oxford Companion to Women's Writing in the United States. Erotica, witchcraft, crones, hags. Kathy just mentions sex goddesses. Linda, can I ask you to attack one of those for me, please?
Well, we have various sized essays, for one thing. The ones you've just mentioned, I think, were 200-word pieces. But we thought it was important that people be able to find a term that, say, Leslie Marmon Silko might have used in her writing. And as we said, we really want this to be a very helpful book. You may have noticed the quantity of cross-references follow each of those entries. And so we're trying to lead readers from one idea to another.
Well, let's pin one of these down. What do you have to say in the Oxford Companion about crones or witches? Now, those seem like, you know, maybe, the National Enquirer? Why in the world would they belong in the Oxford Companion, you know, all that academic highfalutin stuff?
Well, we begin by saying that the crone, first of all, is a very nasty stereotype that was often used indiscriminately about anybody who was an unmarried woman. And that also there were certain women, and we're talking back in the 17th century, who thought that was unfair and who reinvented the crone as a positive figure instead of a negative figure. And there are literary people, including Emily Dickinson, who use the word crone in a very loaded context to have a positive rather than a negative valence, as somebody who's outside the mainstream, and precisely because she's outside of the mainstream, can critique it, can look at it with a critical eye.
Fair enough.
And Dickinson, in fact, refers to herself as a crone. Uh-huh. So taking an extremely negative word and then turning it into something positive, which is also one of the points of having words like this in the book.
What about a large word, Linda, like sexism? Now, I mean, Americans don't have a particular purchase on that. I guess you can look at any world culture, any literary history, and find it. Is there any special spin on what's going on in the United States?
Well, sometimes we were able to find writers who would take one side or another of the issue, and then you find a compound entry so that you get one reading of a term like sexism, or that we did this with pornography, mm-hmm. for example, mm-hmm. so that you get the history of one view of pornography, and then in the same entry you have the opposite position.
Well, be specific here for me. What have you got in mind when you say the history of pornography or the history of erotica? What are the variations here?
I think there's two main views. One is the anti-pornography movement that sees pornography always as being demeaning to women. The other is what I would call the anti-censorship movement that says, yes, some images of some pornographic images may demean women, but it's even more demeaning to women and men to think that literary and creative expression must be censored. And those are very different valences, very different ways of dealing with creative expression. And so this essay explores both views, both mm-hmm. the idea that pornography must be controlled and censored, and the idea that, no, we don't want to censor anybody, male or female, and that something good comes from the free expression of ideas, even if something bad also comes from it.
Sure. On maybe a little less sensationalistic level, we could talk about the novelists and the poets that you have included in the Oxford Companion. Linda, how did you make those choices? How far back do you go, for example, when you begin this recounting all of this literary history?
Well, we go back to the beginning, and we come very close to the present. So, you know, it's a substantive range. Anne Bradstreet is there, uh-huh. of course. Phyllis Wheatley is there. Some contemporary writers we had to cut because we simply couldn't find enough information to write even a 300-word biography. That's how current we wanted to be. But we crowded a lot of different biographies into this book to give people.
How does this book help us to rethink the presence of women in, for example, Kathy, you specialized in one of your many literary incarnations. You did a lot of early American literary mm-hmm. historical scholarship or literary scholarship. How do you rethink people like, Linda mentions Phyllis Wheatley or Anne Bradstreet?
Well, I think the most important thing is you rethink them not as singular, not as just firsts or only, but as parts of groups of writers. What often happens is one writer will be picked up in an anthology, such as Phyllis Wheatley or Anne Bradstreet, and you have the sense then that when she's surrounded by Edward Taylor and a number of other male writers, that she was the only one. When you go back and look historically, you realize she was writing as part of a group, a very vibrant group of writers, and we try to contextualize that as well. Mm. The end of the book has a timeline of women writers, which includes as many women writers as we could think of from the beginning to the present, arraigned against historical events, world events, as well as very specific events in women's life, like the invention of disposable diapers or sanitary napkins or bloomers, but also important events like the passage of the 19th Amendment, which allowed women the right to vote, and other events. So you have this sense of women's writing, again, in process, not just writers, but writing, women talking to one another, groups mm-hmm. of women reacting to historical events, as well as fashion and other things.
You include, for example, a word that kind of surprised me to find it, Linda, and that's the word ecology. How does that figure in women's writing? Simply, are we talking about what, Rachel Carson, writers like that? What?
There actually is a biography of Rachel Carson in our book. But no, the whole ecofeminism movement and the interest, the thematic interest of a lot of women writers mm-hmm. in what is basically a universally important issue. In a way, Wayne, you see, that's another move out of what is strictly literature. And we're trying to look at the public writing that deals with this topic.
Do you all have favorite writers? I know that's a loaded question because you have so many people, principally women, but men as well, writing traditions that figure in what you've put together in this Oxford Companion. But are there examples that come to mind, Kathy?
Sure. The period I teach most often is the period around the turn of the 20th century, from the 19th to the 20th century, and I have two favorite writers. One is Edith Wharton, who most people know about. Another one is a writer named Zitkala Saw.
Say that again, please.
Zitkala Saw is her Sioux name. Her English name is Gertrude Bonin. And she has a wonderful, wonderful book that's a memoir of her being taken from her Indian reservation and being brought up in an American boarding school, an English boarding school, and then being brought back to the reservation where her mother does not even recognize her anymore. Mm-hmm. She thinks she's going home, and in fact, the mother doesn't even know who this child is.
Does that have a special resonance for women in the 1990s? Is it a sort of antiquarian kind of thing?
I've never taught the book where my students haven't wept, and I'm talking about the male as well as female students. It's a book that anyone who's ever left home and tried to come back again knows about. It's very powerful.
Linda, you got a favorite or two you can mention?
Our problem is, of course, that we had hundreds of favorites, and even editing the different versions of the essays as we got them didn't dull that excitement. I think some of the best writing in the book is about more contemporary biography, probably. Uh-huh. And I would mention the long essay we have on Toni Morrison, which gives you that sense of excitement. Another long essay on Alice Walker. Other long essays on, you know, Sylvia Plath, Anne Sexton. Uh-huh. Everyone, in each case, I think, trying to re-describe why these authors were important.
Well, now,
there's
here's
nothing
topic.
Repetitious about uh-huh. the biographies that we have.
Here's a topic that's close to your heart. I mean, you've written, a biography of Sylvia Plath, did you not?
Yeah, about 10 years ago.
Yeah. This is a kind of a, maybe not a subject ascending, but this is an important subject these days. Getting women's lives into public circulation in ways that aren't necessarily traditional, mm-hmm. i.e. poetry and novels. Am I right about that?
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. Linda's most recent book is called Telling Women's Lives, and it's about the new women's biography, and mm-hmm. it's precisely about that, the different way you tell a woman's life versus telling a man's life. I want to give away the plot of your book, Linda.
One of the key essays in our book is that Sidonie Smith did a 5,000-word essay on women's autobiography for us.
Beautiful.
We were so lucky that critics would take the time to write
this.
Entirely new materials uh-huh. for us, even though they had done books of their own on the topic.
I should mention, we approached the most famous critics we could, and they wrote for us. Deborah Tannen, the best-selling author Deborah Tannen, wrote on Communication Between the Sexes. Susan Faludi wrote on Backlash for us. We were very bold. We went to the best first, and the best we're willing to write, and often to write on new topics.
Let me mention the title here. We're going to move toward a conclusion of our conversation. It's The Oxford Companion to Women's Writing in the United States. Here's a big order for you, a couple of minutes, if you please. The status of feminism in this country, divided, united, you use the term backlash here, Kathy.
I think one of the, again, the inspirations for this book is we felt that at this point in 1995, we're talking about many different kinds of feminisms. All those plurals are important. That feminism is every bit as alive and well as it ever has been, but sometimes the word has been polluted and people can be afraid of the word. So we wanted to explore that. We wanted to explore
anything that ends with an ism makes people scared.
So yeah. We wanted to explore it.
Sounds like a disease.
Exactly. And a lot of these essays look at those controversies and look at what makes people fearful and tries to explain.
How's it doing in the classroom, Linda? Feminism alive and well on campus?
My hunch really is that students don't want to be considered feminist, but they all respond to the issues as if they were feminist.
Exactly.
Which is what Kathy was saying, that
exactly.
the term itself has gotten kind of a bad rap. I've had a lot of really good men who are feminists, as well as women in undergrad classes at UNC. So I can't believe that, you know, a book like this might help them understand that it's okay to be feminist, to be interested in these issues, and to be well informed about them.
Kathy and Linda, let's conclude our conversation. We should tell our listeners not only about the Oxford Companion to Women's Writing, But what else? You got another book, I mean, just fresh out this month.
One of the things that happened with this book was we discovered so many good books, so many good writers, many of whom were out of print, that we decided we needed another book. And we came up with the Oxford Book of Women's Writing in the United States. That's an anthology of the very best writers, the most exciting, the most different genres that are represented in the Oxford Companion.
And this is hitting the bookstores this month, March
this month,
of 95.
And it's everything from novellas to recipes. Mm-hmm. The last section of the book is called Bodily Pleasures, and it's, in fact, recipes and erotica. Enjoy.
Linda Wagner Martin and Kathy Davidson are the editors-in-chief of the Oxford Companion to Women's Writing in the United States. Linda Wagner Martin teaches at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, Kathy Davidson at Duke University. Linda Wagner Martin's most recent books include Telling Women's Lives, the new biography, and a biography of Gertrude Stein and her family. Kathy Davidson is president of the American Studies Association and the editor of the journal American Literature. Her recent books include 36 Views of Mount Fuji, now available in paperback. Stay tuned for information about writing for an audio cassette of this program. You're listening to Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. My guests this week were Linda Wagner Martin of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and Kathy Davidson of Duke University. Audio tapes of this program are available postpaid for $10. Our address is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 753. That's number 753, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code again, 27709. Send us your comments and suggestions. Our email address is sounding, S-O-U-N-D-I-N-G, at uncecs.edu. Next week, part two of Soundings for Women's History Month. Angela Verdell will be here to talk about her highly acclaimed new novel, The Good Negress. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Partial support for this program came from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.